Ephesians chapter 4. I am really excited about this tonight because Ephesians, first of all, is one of my favorite books. I can't help but be excited about the book of Ephesians. But more than that, we're coming into a new section of Ephesians. Now, the first three chapters are wonderful because, in a sense, it's like the Mount of Transfiguration. You're seeing before you your real position, what God has done for you. And then we come to the next three chapters. In a sense, it's now application. It's taking that which you've learned and know and put it into practice. It's kind of like coming from this ultimate experience that, you know, that some people can understand, and they pride themselves on their intellect. They can understand the doctrinal aspects of the deeper things of the attributes of God. And then there's others who feel that it's all about the ecstatic, ooh, I feel the presence of the Lord, this is wonderful. And you know, the interesting thing is, both of those positions are only half-baked. It's not even that they need to be together, not that you have to understand and feel, but more than understanding and more than feeling, but with understanding and feeling together, combined, leading to what? Practical, doing. Jesus said it, if you know these things, happy are you when you think about them? No. Happy are you when you feel them? No. Happy are you when you do them? And that's the amazing thing. You see, head knowledge needs to be heartfelt, then it's life-changing. And that's really what he's going to be getting into, because the next three chapters we're going to see this stuff turn into practical application. So the first three chapters are who you are. And the next three chapters is, what do you do about that? How do you live that? And the fact is, you can't expect to live like a Christian unless you are one. You can really get messed up. Coming along Christians trying to mimic what it's like to be a Christian. I actually remember a situation that was really quite sad. A good friend of mine back in California was very excited. He found the girl of his dreams and they really hit it off. And she was coming around the church. She was new and, you know, she was doing everything right. Pretty girl. And I was going to marry them. And I got a call from him a week before the wedding. And he said we were getting ready to go to the, you know, I guess some rehearsal or some plan for it. And I'd called her up and I couldn't believe what I heard. She wasn't there and her mom said that she was out. And I said, what? And she didn't get back till like 2 or 3 in the morning. And I'm going, what's going on? He started going, what's going on? So he confronted her on it and she broke down and ended up in a mental hospital. And the reason was, you see, she was just a party girl. She would actually leave dates with him with all purity and niceness, you know, because she was hoping to marry a good Christian man. She was hoping to be a good Christian wife. And so she was doing everything around him just right. But, you know, at night she'd be longing for the old life. So she'd go out in the bars and she'd be sleeping around with guys, you know, all night long, you know, partying. And then the next day she'd start her, okay, I really want to be this good. She thought once she got married, she'd let that old life go. So she kept a secret till a point where it finally just came out. And I thought, you know, here's a good picture of a girl who really, in her mind, thought Christianity was about what you do. The funny thing is, as important as application is, it's much more important who he is and what he's done in you than what you do. Now, if he is in you, and he is your Lord, and if he has saved you, and your heart is changed, now chapters 4 through 6 will make a whole lot of sense. But I would hate for anyone to maybe come here for the first time, and you're going through, okay, you're going to be in a Bible study, and you hear about what you're supposed to do now as a Christian. And okay, all right, this is what a Christian is, okay, I'm going to try to do that. That is not Christianity. Christianity is what God has done for you. And so that's why it's so important to have the first three chapters down. And we'll keep reminding you on that every time we get into the application, because this is the tendency of religion, is to digress from an experience with God, knowing Him, to just acts of goodness and love and kindness and let's all love one another and all the things you do and purity and holiness. And I love the transition. Last time we looked at the transition. What's the transition? Now unto him who is able to do all that you ask or think. Well, no, more than that. Exceedingly abundantly above all that you ask or think. Because that is the transition going into the next section. So now we get into what we do. So let's jump into chapter 4, verse 1. I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord. I love that because Paul is saying that he's not a prisoner of Rome. And you might look at his circumstances and go, ah, well, you know, nothing's really happening there. God must have really just let him down and he's not coming through for him. He should have let him out. Where's the power of God seen in this? Paul says, no. Don't ever mistake my being in prison for the failure of God to act. In fact, that's where 3/4 of the New Testament was written by Paul, or at least 3/4 of his writings, while he was in prison. The prison epistles are powerful. And even so, while he was there, he didn't waste any time. He was still ministering. He was still praying for others. He's still doing all these things. He was a prisoner of the Lord, not of Rome. Well, as long as the Lord wants him in there. So how he's going to show practically the power, even while you're under circumstances. Now listen, I can't help but think many of you right now are in circumstances you're not too happy about. Whether it's your job, maybe you're depressed about something else, about health, or maybe you're depressed about something in your family, the uncertainty of tomorrow, maybe you've got some health issues. There could be all kinds of things you're weighted with, and you're feeling like under the weather or under the circumstances. But listen, how can you say that when the Lord wants to show His power in the midst of them? Remember, it's not so much He's going to remove those obstacles and mountains and difficulties as much as He's going to give you the power. And that's why He says, unto him who is able to do. So then He says, I therefore, a prisoner of the Lord, beseech you, I beg you, I plead with you to walk worthy of the calling with which you are called. Now again, you see, now this is the therefore. After everything He said in the first 3 chapters, now therefore, walk worthy of that calling. What's the calling? Well, that we'd have to review the first 3 chapters for that, right? Because that's what your calling is. The first 3 chapters is what He's done for you. He's blessed you with every spiritual blessing. In chapter 1, you were chosen, you were adopted, you were made accepted before God in Jesus. You were redeemed, you were forgiven. He gave you wisdom and an inheritance. You were sealed by the Spirit. That's just chapter 1. That's your calling. That's your position in Christ. Then in chapter 2, He reminds you, you know, you were once dead, now you are alive. You've been saved by grace. You were once far off as the Gentiles. Now you've been brought near. You have access to God, the Creator of the universe. And He's just getting started. Then chapter 3, you've been made fellow heirs, partakers of His promise. And the unsearchable riches of Christ have been given to you. Christ dwelling in your hearts, you're rooted and grounded in love, and you comprehend with the width, the length, the depth, the height, the love of Christ, and filled with all the knowledge of God. So this, in a sense, is your calling. I don't know if you feel that, and I don't know if you understand that. But the more you understand, the more we truly walk by faith and believe that, now we're going to say, all right, if that's truly me, now I'm going to live that. I'm going to believe that. Listen, too many of us are just trapped in the old life because, look, we still have the old body. It still feels like I can't overcome that sin. Still feels that temptation's too strong for me. Still feels like, man, I still want to punch that guy out when he said that, you know. Because this is how we feel. We're married to this old flesh. We're still attached to this world. We have to remember that those chains have actually been removed. But our minds have so imprinted those habits of the past, we need to be renewed in our spirit of our mind. I've used this illustration before about the little puppy dog that was trained in the kitchen. My friend had the little bars set so the puppy dog couldn't go into the living room. But the little dog, when they would go into the living room, he would come up and slide up to the place where the bars were and stick his nose through the bars, longingly looking to go in the other room. And yelping and barking like he wanted to go in. But he couldn't. The bars kept him from it. But finally the day came when the little dog was trained. And they took the bars down. And they went in the other room. And the little dog, they thought, would follow them right in the room. But instead the little dog went up to where the bars were, slid and stopped and put his nose where the bars used to be and would not go any farther. Because in his mind he couldn't go. The bars were gone. But it's so implanted in his mind, it took them a while to coax him to go to the other room that he actually could. You might have seen this in animals, you know, the imprint. Well, listen, don't forget how imprinted you have been from your former life. So much so that you might just mistake it as you're still there. But that's not the case. If you've truly experienced the salvation of the Lord, you truly believe on what He's done for you, you now need to walk by faith. And that's why it's described as walking worthy of this calling. Now, Jesus said some interesting things about worthiness, remember? He said, listen, in Matthew 10:37, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now try to get that concept across to an unregenerated Italian family. Sorry, that's not going to happen. Never go against the family. That's primary. Family is it. You know, they definitely have the thing, it's like family, then maybe God, and you know, I mean, it's family. Now think about that for a moment. When Jesus says this, that's pretty bold. If you love father or mother or son or daughter more than me, you're not worthy of me. What is he saying? Well, he's saying is that your position in Christ so far transcends any human relationship that when you really know that, you'll see it in perspective. None of those relationships can compare. In fact, only as you truly know your relationship with your father is in the right place can you truly be a good husband or father or wife or mother or daughter or child, you know, in every respect. Jesus says, he that does not take his cross up and follow after me is not worthy of me. In Matthew 10:38. If you're not taking up your cross, why? Because this is the whole point. If you truly know who you are in Christ, whatever you suffer in this world to be his witness, to be faithful to what he's called you to, that's just momentary light affliction. Because you see this greater glory. And so really all that's required when you think about walking worthy is just being consistent with who you really are, the real you. You know, people in the world say, well, I just got to be me. Well, you should say that as a Christian. Just make sure you know who the real me is, who the real you is. Who are you now in Christ? Do you know that? I'll tell you, that's why twice Paul prayed, remember? Those prayers that you would know the hope of your calling, know the true riches of the glory of the inheritance, that you would know, to understand the power of God, to understand who He is and what He can do. Because when you understand that, and then you walk by faith, you see, you're going to walk worthy of that. See, it's just essentially a walk that matches the ability already given you. It's been given to you. Ahead of us are going to be a lot of great exhortations in chapters 4 through 6. I mean, there's like faithfulness to serve one another, to put off the old man, put on the new, put away lying, put away anger. He's going to say put away stealing, love one another, being wise, not getting drunk, being filled with the Spirit. He's going to talk about husbands and wives and parenting and work and spiritual battles. All of these exhortations are examples of walking worthy of this amazing position and calling. None of those can be done if you don't have that calling. That's why you need to make sure of that calling, to make sure that you truly have trusted the Lord and not yourself. But the idea is, you're not going to continue in sin now that you have this inheritance. If you won the lottery, say you were working down at Joe's Bar and Grill, whatever, you know, cleaning floors, toilets, making $5.50 an hour. And you won $20 million in the lottery. Now, honestly, are you going to continue working for $5.50 an hour cleaning toilets? I sure hope not. I sure hope that you realize, wow, I don't have to do that anymore. Now, of course, money ruins people in a whole other level, so it's a bad illustration. But the point is, you see, if you lived like a pauper when you were rich, it wouldn't make sense. Well, I can tell you there's a lot of Christians still living, sucking on the bottle of sin when they have been so delivered and they just have not come into an awareness. Now, as a baby in Christ, it takes some time to be aware of who you are and your surroundings, and that you can walk and talk, and that you can learn. And it takes a while to learn to let that which is already the innate ability in you come out. And when the Holy Spirit is in you, it's there. It's just that if you don't practice it, if you don't use it, then it's almost as if you don't have it. Why do you think there's not much difference sometimes between people that don't know Jesus and people who are Christians? In fact, sometimes people who don't know Jesus live better lives morally than people who go by the name of Christ. Because either those who go by the name of Christ aren't really His, or they just have not begun to walk by faith, put that old life aside. All the bitterness and the begrudging, and you've got to prove yourself right, and you've got to be, you know, in control, and all those sinful things that just trap us into that old way, instead of walking like Jesus walked. So this is what it means to walk worthy. Now, the qualities of this new walk are given in verse 2. Notice what he says here. With all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, or patience, bearing with one another in love. You know, lowliness is really it's humility. Lowliness, again, because by nature we tend to be high-minded. We have an inflated opinion of ourselves all too often. And, or if not anything else, it's just even if we're down on ourselves, we tend to think everybody, you know, doesn't like us, and it's not fair because I don't like myself because I should be better. I should be more notable. People should like me more. And it's a weird complex of how much we get into ourselves. But a person who's truly humble, it's the most delicious thing to be because it's self-forgetful. You're not even thinking of yourself. You know, look, if you ever go into a crowded room, you know, and like your doctor's office, don't you hate it when you open the door and it's jam-packed and everybody's looking at you? And you go in there and you're very self-conscious. You're looking for a seat and you want to get to the seat as soon as possible and sit down and just not bring attention to yourself, right? Because we're very self-conscious. We don't want to have that kind of attention. We get really nervous about ourselves. And you know, when you think about it, it's because we're just preoccupied with ourselves. But if a truly humble person doesn't even give it a thought. He goes into the office, he sees people, hey, how you doing, you know? Sits down. He's not thinking of himself at all. It's a wonderful experience. So pride is often the thing that gets in our way because we're so self-conscious. We're thinking, you know, people are looking at us, is my hair okay? You know, do I look okay? You know, and I'm always wondering about myself. I'm very, and you know, listen, Madison Avenue feeds on this obsession that we all have. Because we've got to look the right part. We've got to dress right. We've got to smell right. We've got to look right. And, you know, how many of those advertisements for deodorants, you know, just drive me crazy. You know, the guy has the right deodorant and five women are at his arm. Oh, I like this guy. Smelling his armpit like as if it's supposed to be really good. It's like, give me a break. Is that the same? Have you ever seen that one? That's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. She's over there under his armpit. And, you know, but you know, we're out there buying the product. Oh, I want that, man. That's going to help me. The point I'm saying is that when you truly have true humility, you're not even thinking about yourself. Now, hopefully you're not going to stink, you know, and not worry about it. If someone says, hey, go use something, you know, that's another thing. But true humility is like you're not self-conscious. And, you know, in a way, you're not, listen, we're so much in competition with each other all the time, comparing ourselves with others. You know, people who are very insecure often have to tear others down because that's how they look better. You know, insecure people are very dangerous to be around. They're very deadly because you never know when they're going to throw a barb at you to put you down so they look better or undermine you or talk behind your back. And they've always got to be the one that knows, and they've got to be, because they've got to keep putting themselves up. You know, Herod, good example. I mean, he was a little short guy, and he was so insecure, he thought everyone was plotting to get him. It was said of Herod, it was safer to be his pig than his son. Because his sons, he was envious and jealous of, and was always thinking they're going to try to take over my throne, and he had them put to death. His own wife, he was suspicious of. He was an insecure little man, and he had to bring everybody else down with his power. But when you're humble, you don't have to think about that. You're not concerned about that. It doesn't bother you. You know, it's been said, deep waters run quiet, but shallow waters babble on. And it's true. The more we have to talk about ourselves, the more we have to keep dropping dimes. You know, have you ever been around people that they're name droppers, you know? They're always throwing different people out that they've talked with, that they've been with, that they know. And, I know him. And, oh, yeah, you know, and they throw all these names in a conversation. So they just want you to know there's somebody important. And, you know, again, it's insecurity. Now, listen, to some degree, honestly, we all do it. Because by nature, we're all insecure. And it's the Lord that wants to show us that from our new glorious position, we can walk in humility. That's what I love about someone who's truly walking in the Spirit. There's a humility about them. You're not intimidated by them. They make you feel very comfortable because they're outward facing. They're not insecure themselves. They're going to make you feel comfortable. They're sensitive to you. You know, plants with the most fruit lie closest to the ground. Humility is an amazing thing. The problem is, it's one of those things, as soon as you think you have it, you lose it. Because as soon as you're conscious about it, am I humble? That's a hard question. Humility doesn't even ask the question. Just true humility is, it's you're so focused on the Lord and others, you're not thinking about yourself. And it's a wonderful thing. And it's something you really want to pray, Lord, just help me with humility. Of course, He will find ways to humble you if you don't humble yourself. It's much better if you just humble yourself. Take the lower seat. Keep your mouth shut when you're tempted to boast about yourself. When you're tempted to talk bad about somebody else to make, you know, yourself look intelligent and understanding and I know what's going on and, you know, all under the guise of, we're going to pray for them. You know, I hate that one. That's the most evil, spiritual cloak you can wear is gossiping about others under the guise of, oh, pray for so-and-so, you know what happened, blah, 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 you know, oh, we're going to pray for them. Get the holy look. We'll pray. Lord, help us. So humility. I love this one poem is, I walked a mile with pleasure. She chattered all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and never a word said she, but all the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. You know, there's sometimes those trials and difficulties and pains keep us humble in a way, keep us dependent upon the Lord, remind us that we aren't in control like we think. And we need to learn that. And it's merciful of the Lord to show us. And so we're told to let this mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus. Though He were God, He was the very Son of God, yet He came in the form of a man and is a servant. I think about His position. Now maybe some of you were huge on Wall Street and then you got just hit hard with all this whole crisis. And now you're living much more simply and it's uncomfortable driving a clunker of a car when you were driving the best or living in someplace maybe more humble. You know, you go from here to there, it's hard. Imagine Jesus in His glory having to come down and just being perfect and sinless and being in a world full of sin, self-interest, and evil. And yet He did that for us. Second is gentleness. Gentleness or meekness. Gentleness is a good word, though. You know, people that are very gentle, they hold your life and reputation very carefully. They're kind in that sense. They're gentle. When you need to even approach someone about maybe something they're doing wrong, Galatians 6 says, if you see a brother or sister in sin, you go to that one in gentleness, meekness, knowing that you yourself could be tempted as well. You're not more important than they are. But what you realize is that it's in a real way, you're wanting to win them because there's a gentleness. You're hoping the best for them, which is why you can't be quiet when their sin abounds. You must say something for righteousness' sake. But you do it in a way because you care for people. It's not a holier-than-thou talking down upon someone for their lifestyle. But it's a pity, it's a concern, a compassion for someone that's going down the wrong road. And this is very, very important when it comes in a church. Because, listen, tomorrow Some of you are going to do some things you shouldn't do. Some of you hearing this voice will be doing some things you shouldn't do. And hopefully there will be some brother or sister that will represent Jesus in trying to win you back. And they'll do it in such a way that is gentle, and you know they care about your soul. You see, that's very important. If you know somebody truly cares about you, you tend to really respect what they're saying to you. If they have to approach you about something, because they know you love them. And there's a gentleness there. I'll never forget one of the illustrations of this when Chuck Smith, in his book, When Grace Changes Things, he shared about having a couple in his fellowship, a man that was very successful, had a beautiful home, beautiful wife and kids. He got caught up in an emotional affair, and then, of course, that turned into a physical affair, and he left his wife. And Chuck had gotten the address of where he was with this woman, and he went to visit him, and when he got there, he came up to this, just a humble little shack almost, and he thought, man, this guy left this beautiful house and beautiful wife and children. And he opened the door, and this woman that he was with was nothing special, and he was just choked up, and of course his friend was shocked to see him there and invited him in, and it was kind of an awkward silence, because, you know, the friend knew, you know, what was coming. And Chuck sat down, and he was so taken with emotion and care for his friend who had gone down this road. It just broke his heart. He was choked up. He couldn't speak, and he just started weeping. And he apologized. I'm sorry. And he couldn't even talk, and he actually had to excuse himself and leave. And he says, I'm so sorry. And he left, and he felt like he failed. He was like driving home. He was like, God, forgive me. I couldn't even say anything. I just blew that. I wanted to talk to him about his soul. And the Holy Spirit said, no, you didn't blow it. Next week, he was in church, back with his family. It so touched the man that it was a gentleness. And I think there is a gentleness that we need to learn when we get around people. Look, none of us are perfect. There are going to be people that are going to hurt you. They're going to let you down. They're going to say things about you. Look, we're in where people are, there's going to be a mess, okay? Just the way it is. But when you want to walk in the Spirit, when you want to walk worthy of the calling the Lord has given to you, this is going to be a part of it. Long-suffering. This is another quality so powerful. Patience. To us, it's like, well, what's the big deal if I'm impatient? You know, I'm in a line. In fact, I found my whole character change when I came out here. Honestly. You know, I don't know what it was. I mean, in California, we're just used to waiting in lines for everything, and we're very patient, and no one says anything. And I kind of think, because everyone's afraid to say anything. But out here, you get in a line, and it's like, you get a little impatient, you start making comments. You know, is anybody over there? I've been here for 20 minutes. You know, we start getting really impatient. But, you know, I don't believe that the word here is meant to convey just that kind of, okay, learn how to be patient. It's a much deeper word. It's translated long-suffering. It actually means, in a sense, you're abiding under. You're enduring over a long period of time. And in a way, the Bible tells us we have need of patience so that after we've received the promise, that we may be able to hold on to it and keep going. See, that's the challenge. When you've experienced salvation, it is not always apparent all the answers to your life come. And now you endure a lot on the journey as the Lord is working in you. And we need patience to endure that. We need patience. And sometimes, you know, we're praying for an answer. How many of you are waiting for the answer to some prayer or another? I mean, come on. Let's get 3/4, 7/8 of us here. Most of us. We're waiting for something. And we need patience, don't we? Because we can get impatient with God. And you know, when you get impatient, remember, God allowed Job to be tried. Job was known for what? Patience. The patience of Job is proverbial. Why? Because he was in great abject pain and difficulty, but he never railed on God. He trusted the Lord. In fact, the epitome of expression of patience is, though he slay me, he said, I will obey and trust in him. That's practicing patience, because he knew what he had. And it was much more important than having the satisfaction of cursing God for his experience for a few moments of pleasure, thinking he's like, well, I'll let God know what I think. You know, it's so funny because I actually was like that. When I was in high school, I thought it's such a pathetic thing for Christians to try to be good. And I think you guys are pathetic creatures. I really thought that. Because, you know, this God is going to expect more and more and more. He's never going to be enough. And you're always going to be trying to be good, and for what? And so I thought it was very cool to curse God. You know, I remember used to put language together and literally just foul mouth toward God. I would listen to my acid rock lyrics, you know, Pink Floyd, and I was nicknamed that when I got in the sun, but just I liked the music at the time, and you know, but a lot of those words were really blasphemous. They really were, and I remember the end of one of them. You know, you had to listen really carefully to one of the songs that says, "We're going to make the bugger's eyes water." And we're speaking of God. We're going to rise up and we're going to punch God in the nose and make his eyes water. And the idea was just that boastful thing. And that's the opposite of this word right here. Because that implies I will never take anything from anybody, including God. That pride, where the opposite of that is, you know, you believe that God is allowing these circumstances for your good, though now it's painful, now it's difficult. You have patience so that afterwards you'll receive the reward. And then finally, in this quality, bearing with one another, the end of verse 2, bearing with one another in love. Ah, that's the challenge, isn't it? Have you ever met somebody that never did anything that ever bothered you? No. And of course, you probably have. You think they have never bothered you because you really don't know them that well. You know, like when a boy and a girl are coming together, they've met each other and they're excited, they love each other and they're going to get married. And as they get married, you know, you start unpeeling the onion, you start learning more things about your spouse, and you go, oh, I don't like that. If I'd have known about that, I don't know. And you know, it's a good thing I said I do then, because if I saw that now, I might not say I do. You know, you start seeing things that really annoy you. Listen, living with anybody, anytime, any place, I don't care who it is, and Mother Teresa, there's going to be something that's going to annoy you. And this is why the problem really isn't them. It really, really is us. If I'm annoyed and maybe some habit my wife has, it just bugs me, and I think my whole duty in life is to change her from doing that. I've got to, now honey, now this, look, I've showed you how to do this once already, now you do, this is how it goes. How come you can't, it's so simple. How many guys can hear yourself in that little conversation, right? And you get annoyed because it's like someone isn't doing it the way you want it. And then you read more into it. You don't love me, do you? Because if you love me, it would be important enough for you to remember to do that, wouldn't you? But you really don't love me. And then you start getting yourself all worked up. See, this is the opposite of this word. Bearing with one another in love is to realize realization, look, we all have our idiosyncrasies. We all have our issues. We've got issues, believe me. Every one of us. And you know what? When you learn how to just accept others, see, that's the secret of a good, long-standing marriage, is you just accept one another. Kind of reminds me of the couple that were celebrating their 50th, and you know, they went up and they wanted them to say a few words, and you know, they were, what's the secret of your success? How did you make it 50 years in marriage? You know, you have to have some secrets to make 50 years. And the guy says, well, I kind of figured that, you know, it's rather simple. You know, when anything ever bothered me, I just went for a long walk outside, and you know, until I settled down. And then he says, largely, I've lived an outdoor life. You know, whatever it takes. You see, this is what it is. It's bearing with one another. You know, seriously, the hardest thing, there's a couple of things I'm thinking about this. I'm going to go on a couple of tracks here. The first one is missionaries. You know, missionaries are people that are very specially minded, to willing to sacrifice a lot of luxury and life over here, to live in some place of the world that's uncomfortable, hot, cold, you know, bugs, whatever it might be, language, you know, a whole different people, you know, you defer all of that you could have had to help people because you love people. Well, they're a special breed already, right? But, you know, missionaries have one huge problem that occurs that often is the number one reason why they don't last on the mission field. And you know what it is? It's working with other missionaries. You see, because, you know, you're willing to endure whatever it takes for the sake of the people, but you expect more from another missionary. And we tend to think, well, they should be more spiritual. And you start getting frustrated and you start getting bitter and people let you down. And then it becomes like a mountain in your mind. And then once you become bitter, pretty much you're on the shelf. God's going to have to put you back and let you set for a while. Simmer, you know, till the self-smell reeks, you know, away from you a little bit. But that's the problem. And really what it comes down to is bearing with one another in love. Putting up with people that are different. You know, people that are very critical, be very, very careful around them. Especially when they're very critical of others. They'll say, hey, well, you're not like, you're my best friend, but boy, look at you, ever notice some so-and-so, and you don't look at that, but you don't know, what was that person over there? And Mr. So-and-so said to Mrs. N, when I was passing L's house, over here, you know, and they start talking about others, and they're very critical about everything. They notice every little thing. You notice the pastor, how he did that. You notice the church. How about that song? Did you like that song? I didn't like that song. Why did he sing that song? We never sung that song before. And, you know, people will get really critical about all these things. Be very careful. I would avoid people like that. Because there's something wrong. You know, in fact, it should be the opposite. You always put the best face on others. You always put them in the best light. You always give them the benefit of the doubt. That's what a believer does. That's what bearing with one another in love is. If you see them impatient, you go, you know, I'm going to pray for them. They must have had a rough day. If you see them frustrated, you know, you don't like, aha, I knew they weren't as spiritual as they thought they were, you know. It's like that's godless. But the true believer is going to be patient and all of these things. Lowliness, gentleness, long-suffering, bearing with another in love. Why? When you have an understanding of what God has done for you, this is easy. It really is. You are so thankful for being saved. You're so thankful for the new life the Lord has given you. You're so outward facing to bless others, you're not thinking of yourself. You're going to be very gentle with them when they're stumbling in sin because you were there. Oh, let me help you. You're going to be patient with them because you understand, you know, what you've got, the Lord forgave you of all that junk. What is it to forgive them a little bit, to be patient? And even with what you have to endure, I'm thankful. I'm thankful. And of course, bearing with one another in love. You see, it all comes there because it's a result of one who's walking worthy of their calling. They get it. And that's why these qualities befit this new demeanor or walk. And then verse 3, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Listen, this is really amazing. You know, having the power and the position for the humility and the meekness and patience and forbearance, that sets the stage for everything else in this chapter. In fact, the rest of this is all about unity. It's about unity. It's a key message to the rest of this chapter. Unity in the body, unity in gifts, in the purpose of assembling together. Unity is a very important thing. See, because sin has divided us. Sin makes us think I'm the most important. What I feel, what happens to me is most significant. Sin makes us way too subjective. We're in the center. The world around us, in fact, amplifies this. You know, you are special. You are special. You know, the Bible tells us we're special, but you see, we often try to be more special than someone else. And it kind of reminds me of the line in The Incredibles. You know, in the little shrimp has to have this special ability because he's envious of all the specials, all those people with supernatural powers. So he says, you know, he's going to make everybody special because when everybody is special, nobody will be special. And I don't know why I like that line so much. But, you know, that's a person that's so conscious of what he wants. And when in reality, you know, when you are truly self-forgetful. It's an amazing thing that happens. It unifies you with people. Because you don't have to prove yourself. You're more important than them. You can, in fact, rejoice in somebody else's ability that's better than yours. You're thankful when you find somebody that's more articulate or more gifted, more this or that, because you want to build them up. And it's a wonderful thing. Listen, I would love nothing more than young men to catch a pastor's heart calling and start growing in this ministry just with the articulation of the gospel and the anointing on their life, that every one of you, when I'm gone somewhere and they fill in, they go, wow, that was awesome. And they come back and say, Pastor, you should go more often. We want to hear him. I would love that. I would not be threatened by that at all. That would be awesome. Because I would see, look, if the Lord called me out, then he called me out. He's raised somebody else up. That's great. I don't care. Whatever the Lord wants, I want to follow him. And there's something freeing about that. We need to have this. It's a unity that comes. And so he basically says the unity spells out in this way. There's one body and one spirit. You're called in one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. One God and Father of all, who is above all, through all, and in you all. Seven times the word one is emphasized. And body life delivers us from morbid self-centeredness. Learning how to get along in a body. But boy, we've found a way to avoid that, haven't we? Because you can go to a big church, come in and watch the show, listen to the musicians, listen to the pastor. Very nice, very, very nice, very nice. And then leave. And no one knows your name. No one knows who you are. No one knows. Listen, that is not the way to do church. If you do, you're shortchanging yourself hugely. Or even worse yet, the whole world church internet thing. You know, I could have church on the internet. There's actually pastors that, I don't know what their point is, but they think, you know, I'm gonna have internet church and I'm gonna get my congregation to come in and they'll give through the internet and we'll do everything through the internet. And I'll counsel and minister and I'll pray for them over the internet. Type, Dear Jesus, bless Sister Sue, you know. Listen, I want to tell you something. There's something dynamically missing about that. Or just even radio. Now, radio is better than TV. TV is so focused on sometimes the images, you don't really listen. Radio is more intimate. You really hear when you're listening to a message. But even so, it's still not the same as having fellowship. Because this is the key. See, we need to have diversity within our experience. That's what a body is. It's unity with diversity. You know that. I mean, a body has many parts. Those parts have only one thing in common. They're made up of cells. But the eye and the ear and the, you know, the liver and the pancreas and the heart and the leg and the fingernail, they're all totally different. And yet, none of them have any real meaning by themselves. And you know, in a way, that's kind of how we need to look at ourselves. We don't have our full meaning and purpose in life unless we're face-to-face and arm-in-arm locked together with others in this common calling the Lord has called us. One body. You know, the unity and listen, I've seen attempts at unity is not uniformity. That's very important to know that. Listen, this is where churches start getting legalistic when they start going in a way to try to get unity by making everybody uniform. No, listen, you don't do that because your body parts are so different, but they all work together. And everybody in the body, you're all uniquely you. I mean, uniquely your personality. You do not want to try to be... Listen, in my first few years as a pastor, I was trying to be my pastor, Raul. Because that's kind of like what I thought, you know, that's what I modeled. And so I would speak like Raul, I'd act like Raul, you know, and I'm not Raul. It's really neat, man, what the Lord is doing, I'm telling you. It's interesting to me. I have all those little sayings I used to follow him in. But you know what? After a while, I just learned, Lord does not want another Raul. He wants me to be me, and he doesn't want you to be me. He wants you to be you. We all have unique abilities and gifts. I think it's wonderful. But the unity comes when each of those different parts, they work together. No individual body part makes any sense without the whole. And that is so needed. And unity cannot be manufactured. Listen, I've seen attempts at uniformity in churches where all the members are expected to dress the same way, talk the same way. In fact, that's what turned me off the church, even as a young believer. I got really, really turned off at church. It was a very traditional church in Michigan. I won't mention any names. It wasn't my home church in my hometown. It was when I was in the university. But I remember going to this church and, I felt so out of place. I didn't have nice clothes, first of all. I had just real casual clothes that I wore. I never needed any dress-up clothes. And everybody at church, man, had their finery on. And, man, they had their language was so like the language of Canaan. Some biblical phrases and just the way the pastor would speak with that pastoral tone. It was one of those things when you really get spiritual, you know how to talk with that pastoral tone. And I felt like I just didn't fit in. Because what happened is everybody was trying to be like everybody. Everyone, it was uniformity. That's when legalism gets a hold of a church. Where as soon as you do anything a little bit different, people look at you. What are you doing over there? And so you're like, all of a sudden you feel that pressure to conform. Oh, maybe I said something wrong. And that's what I felt. Every time I would leave church, I'd be like, did I say something wrong? That lady looked at me really funny. Did I do something wrong? I was always questioning, what did I do? And I was trying my hardest to fit in. And I never felt, and I remember thinking, it's me. I don't fit in. There's something wrong with me. And I remember going out to California and going into Calvary Chapel West Covina. And Raul Reese was up there, you know, with shorts and a t-shirt on and opening his Bible. And he was like, let's turn to chapter 5, man. It's really neat. And he was butchering the English language in the beginning. And everyone, I'm looking around, and I was the nicest dressed person there. I thought, all right, I felt at home. You know, the point is, it's not that Calvary Chapel is everything. It's not. In fact, we have our own little ways. We start boasting in our own Calvary Chapelness. Forgive us. Please don't do that. You know, God has wonderful people in so many other churches around here. And just they're laboring for the Lord. I've met a whole bunch of wonderful pastors in this East Coast area. So we're not the only ones. There's a lot of great fellowships. And we're all different. We're all unique. Even fellowships itself take on a different personality. You know, we have our unique style. You know, and it doesn't mean we've got the right way. In fact, there's always things I'd like to pep up a little bit here, you know, when it comes to ministry. But the Lord knows. And the point is, this is really it. There's one body, and that's as far as we're going to get today. Because these other ones are so important to bring this all in together. Because remember, he's laying this whole foundation. Walking worthy is about these qualities that are very self-forgetful. Because you have been filled. You don't have to try to prove yourself or try to boost yourself up on the ruins of somebody else. You can now love. You can be patient. You can be gentle. And you realize you have been given gifts and abilities unique to you, but not so you boast in them, look at me, but rather so that you can serve one another. That's what the heart does. It pumps furiously to feed blood to the rest of the body. And the veins, they carry that blood. Kidneys filter that blood. And it gives enzymes. Everyone has a different part. We do our part. So I pray, we will begin to walk worthy.